Today on Against the Grain, in a society that devalues ideas, perhaps it's not surprising that the thought processes of children receive little interest. Yet, as psychologist Susan Engel argues, children are constantly constructing ideas, often collaboratively, although this impulse is often dampened by the wider world. And she suggests that we ignore the mental processes of children at our peril, since the creativity of adults often stems from their engagement with ideas in childhood. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Adults show little curiosity about the inner life of ideas that every child has. In fact, as Susan Engel argues, the notion that children have their own intellectual lives might come as a surprise to most adults. And yet, by six, most children will have the ability to devise and meld ideas of their own. Engel, in her new book, The Intellectual Lives of Children, which was published by Harvard University Press, details the processes at work in children's minds and how they're frequently discouraged, including in the classroom. Susan Engel teaches psychology at Williams College and is also the author of The Hungry Mind, about curiosity in childhood. Susan, what do we know about the relationship between childhood and our ideas and our thought processes as adults?
So we know that the different elements of forming an idea begin in very early childhood. And, you know, to pursue an idea, to develop an idea, takes all kinds of skills and types of knowledge. I mean, the most basic one is the ability to think in language or some kind of symbolic form that allows you to think about things, to think without acting. And most humans acquire that quite easily and naturally, you know, in the first 2 or 3 years of life. But there are other skills involved in putting an idea together. As I said, like putting information together in a new way or using a piece of information or a tool differently than you have before for, you know, and those capacities start, and that's really the claim of my new book, that those capacities start in early in life. And the interesting thing, or the interesting question to me, is why some people really keep developing those skills to the point where as children, older children or young adults, they can pursue ideas and they like to. Not every child goes on sort of honing those skills. So every child develops the basic elements early in life, just in as a function of being active and playing and you know, getting through everyday life. But whether that keeps developing depends a lot on the experiences.
You write about the remarkable leap that our minds take between being a newborn and just a mere 3 years later. What is that leap and how does it happen?
One of the things I say in the book that I've thought about often is that we often compare baby, you know, human babies to other species and think about how slow development is in humans. So all kinds of mammals seem more skilled and more able, like a horse, you know, jumps up and walks within mere moments or hours of birth, and they can feed themselves and they can begin running around. I mean, they can do things so quickly compared to the human infant who seems helpless for so long. And yet, when you think about what happens in the first 3 years of the human baby's life, it's totally extraordinary, because not only do they learn to walk and feed themselves and do all the things a puppy or a baby horse can do, but they learn this whole other layer that catapults them into a completely different experience. So they learn to talk. And with that acquisition, the ability to talk, They learn how to think about what's happened in the past, what might happen in the future, what something could be like if you behave differently. They develop the seeds of what we call counterfactual thinking. And any parent or grandparent who listens to this show and doesn't know what I'm talking about, just imagine the 2 or 3 year old who plays with some figures. My little grandson was over a little while ago. He's 23 months, and he was playing with some blocks and some little toy guys, and he made a tractor out of the blocks and put the little guy on top of the tractor and said he was driving a tractor. And then he took it apart and he turned the blocks into a house and said the guy was sitting in his house. That ability to rethink reality and to try out different scenarios is the beginning of the capacity to speculate. And speculation is one of the greatest gifts of the human species. It's sort of what makes us scientists and artists and every other thing that we achieve like that.
And Susan Engel, you've written a lot about curiosity and the curiosity that children have in early childhood that then can ebb with time, but that one of the dimensions to that process, which is relevant here, is a kind of a winnowing process, whereas for a baby, they're curious about absolutely everything they see. But the older they get, they start to think, this is what interests me, or this captures my attention. How does that dimension relate to the development of ideas in children?
You ask the best questions. So as you say, babies, curiosity, I'll just sort of sum it up quickly. As curiosity is basically the urge to explain the unexpected or to reduce uncertainty. And so something happens that you've never seen before or that's new to you and you're a year and you want to figure out what's going on. You want to explain it to yourself. So you investigate, you put it in your mouth, you tap it, you ask questions about it, whatever. And when you think about that, it explains why curiosity is so ubiquitous in infancy. Every kid is curious and they're curious all day long. And that's because almost everything is surprising to them. Everything's new. There's just so much the day holds that is a first for them. The first time they get a certain kind of a drink, the first time they see a bug climb out from under a rock, and it goes on infinitely. Obviously, by the time children are about 3, a great deal of their everyday life is familiar to them, and it no longer piques their curiosity. And they begin to, as you said, narrow their curiosity to certain things. And I would just pause here and say that every adult listening should be familiar with what I'm saying. None of us are curious about, we're not curious about everything. I'm very curious about food. I love to cook. I love to eat. I'm completely uncurious or incurious about cars. I could pass 20 different cars on the road and I would never notice and I would know nothing about them. So that's sort of, that's the rule, not the exception, that you become specific about what you're interested in and therefore what you're curious about. The thing that interested me and part of what I wanted to write about in this new book was realizing that not only did children seek it, you know, somewhere around the age of 3 or 4, they begin to seek out the certain things that grab them. And what's intriguing to one child is different from what's intriguing to another child. But that in doing that, they go deeper into the topic and they sort of create surprise for themselves. So I talk a lot about a child who was interested in bugs in the chapter on curiosity. The more she learned about bugs, the more very fine points about bugs intrigued her because she had learned all the obvious big things about bugs. So now she could sort of delve in and think, oh, say, why are their wings different from one another? Or why do some fly and some don't? When you're first learning about something, whether you're 3 or 30, the most obvious characteristics are surprising of whatever it is. But the more of that information you sort of get under your belt and become comfortable with, the more you look for surprise in finer and finer details. And that's why children, like adults, can remain incredibly curious about something for a very long time because they keep delving in and creating new surprises for themselves. And that's something I became very interested in because I realized that we tend to think of children as simply being surprised by whatever comes their way, as if they're quite passive, just waiting for a new encounter. But in fact, if you watch children over time, they find things to be curious about, and they sort of construct their own new surprises.
Anybody who remembers themselves as a child or has anything to do with children is aware of how wide-ranging the interests of children are. That one child can be fascinated by construction vehicles and another wouldn't find that at all interesting and find something else just fascinating. But it's interesting that you write in The Intellectual Lives of Children that there are some commonalities in the interests of children, or at least some tendencies, especially when they're very small, toward humans and animals, creatures that are able to sort of act on the world rather than things that seem to be passive. How do you make sense of that?
You know, it's interesting. I'm not sure I totally understand it, but one of the things that seems to interest children are phenomena that are complicated and somewhat dynamic or volatile. So the thing about like animals is that they keep doing things. They make sounds, they move, they're not completely predictable. And that makes sense in terms of what I was saying about curiosity. They keep doing things that are surprising. And one of the things I talk about in the book towards the end is the value of providing children with rich, complex, and somewhat mysterious or unpredictable experiences in their life. Like the impulse to make everything simple and predictable and comprehensible, I think some of that is fine and understandable, and there's a lot of benefit, you know, to giving children a lot of benefit to giving them a sense of routine and order. Absolutely, I wouldn't argue with that. But in terms of helping them develop the ability to pursue ideas and helping them develop sort of lifelong curiosity, there's great value in providing them with the kinds of experiences that are unpredictable, mysterious, and also complex. Children love complexity. So, for instance, if you walk into a nursery school or a kindergarten and watch where the children gravitate, and I learned this in an old study I did about curiosity in classrooms. If there's an aquarium or a terrarium in the room, that's where the kids want to go and watch. And it's because it's so dynamic in there. There's so much going on. And I think that feeds their need, their desire to understand what they don't yet understand. So it's true that a lot of kids love trucks or blocks or stones. I gave an example of that in the book. There are all kinds of inanimate objects that kids are intrigued by. But I think that they have a special fascination for the volatile, lively world of humans and animals. I suppose there may also be some piece of that has to do with the fact that other humans and animals in some way remind them of themselves. That's not something I've looked at, but I bet there is some research that suggests that.
I'm speaking with Susan Engel. She's the author of The Intellectual Lives of Children, which is published by Harvard University Press. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Children, particularly young children, are full of questions, sometimes to the point that adults can't handle it. And they can ask questions that make adults feel uncomfortable. For example, as you write about in the book, questions about sex, which are rarely taken seriously. I think we might guess why that happens, but what are the consequences of not taking children's ideas seriously?
I think the consequence is that you raise children who are less likely to enjoy the pursuit of ideas and have the skills to pursue complex ideas. So I think the stakes are very high, actually, or the consequences are very important. Our survival as a society or a species depends on our ability to build new ideas and to really think through the ideas that other people have built. And we want more people. We need more people who can do that. And one of the things I've thought about a lot in the last few years is what is to all of us if you have a society of people who don't even know an idea when they come across it and don't understand or have the capacity to think through an idea in a careful, rigorous way. So this one way that people sometimes misunderstand my books and my work is when they think that I mean just let children play and let their wonderful imaginations flower and everything will be great. That's not what I'm saying. I do think it's wonderful to let children play, and I do think that they have rich, lively imaginations. But actually, the thing that I'm very interested in these days is how we can help children develop the ability to pursue an idea, even the most reality-bound idea, you know, ideas that solve problems, as I said, or explain mysterious things that happen around us that we need to explain, other people's behavior or economic dynamics or things about the environment, for example. And I think when we push away the things they want to know about, like sex or death, we lose the opportunity to help them build, for want of a better word, their idea muscles. I don't really like that phrase now that I've said it out loud, but the sort of ability to really think about something and to think about something complex. So that's, I want to say something else about that too, which is that kids love to think about things. They love to sink their teeth into a complex idea. And I don't mean an idea that would be complex and interesting to a grown-up. So if you ask them, you know, to think about decision theory, and they're four, they're not going to be interested. I'm not suggesting that. But obviously, some of the examples I give in the book, the children are very interested in what sex is and how it works. And they're very interested in what death is and how it works and what it means for someone to die. So those are two examples of topics that when children ask about them, grown-ups are often uncomfortable. And the mistake is, as I said, one, that they don't get the chance to pursue ideas and think about ideas. And two, that they don't get the chance to think about something they really want to think about. Like, thinking about ideas should be a pleasure, and it is to young children. So the real question is, how do we help them go on finding pleasure in thinking about complex ideas?
Well, why aren't adults particularly curious about or even aware of children's intellectual lives and mental process?
Talking about things I would like, phenomena I would like to explain myself, that's the one I'd like to explain that I haven't fully. But I have some thoughts about it, and I think there's some, already we have some evidence. One reason is that understanding the complexity of children's minds is fairly new in sort of human history and human scholarship. You know, in 1920, 100 years ago, not that many people really thought, or people were just beginning, that was the era of Lev Vygotsky in the Soviet Union, Russia and then the Soviet Union, and Piaget in Geneva. We were just beginning to understand how complex young children's minds were. So understanding the complexity of their thoughts is fairly new in sort of the history of human knowledge about psychology. That's one reason. More recently, I think that the reason we haven't made more progress or built more on that original base, the studies from the early 20th century, is because we've become so focused on training children to be productive workers. Honestly, I think if you look at the educational system, and I talk about this in the book, we're so focused on making sure kids have the skills they'll need to get a job and support the national economy and support themselves. And it's not that those things aren't important. Obviously, everyone deserves to be able to work and make a living. But we've done it at the expense of thinking about how they actually think about things. And of course, the irony there is, in the long run, everyone would be better off if more children if we nurtured the intellectual lives of more children and did more than just let it flower, but really helped them put that to great use. So the cost is great, but I think to answer the question, it's partly because I could go further. I could say that in our society, I'm not sure how much people really care about children. They usually care about their own children, but how much they care about other children and their capacity to think or what they're thinking about, I just don't think that's very common.
Do you think there might be a component that this wouldn't explain the lack of interest necessarily in a different era, but do you think that there's a great value on how adults think and how adults engage with ideas? And if not, could that have an effect on how we view children's ideas?
It's a great way to put it. And yes, I think you are right. I guess I would go even further. I think we've been making this mistake in our educational system and our approach to parenting, broadly speaking, for so long that we have an adult society what I would have said until the last year is that we have an adult population filled with people who don't really value ideas and don't value them in other people and don't value them in their own lives, don't know how to pursue them, aren't inclined to think something through over time and stick with it and gather information to improve their idea or revisit their idea or reconsider, think, oh my gosh, maybe I was wrong. Maybe a different idea would explain this better or solve this problem better. So I think that it's not only that people don't value ideas, and I think you're right about that. They don't even, most people don't know how to have them themselves. The last year, I've begun to think about something that I'm now spending more and more time working on and very worried about, which is most people don't value information. And one, you can't have good ideas if you don't have information with which to build them. Ideas depend on information of one kind or another. So the information, I use the example of my stepfather inventing ways to keep animals in when I was young. He was a farmer. He had a different kind of information than a person who comes up with a new theory to explain economic shifts or dynamics. But both kinds of ideas rest on expertise, on real knowledge, real information. And in the past year or so, you can see both in when people have political conversations and when they have conversations about COVID, they don't seem eager for information. They seem eager to stick to their opinion, whatever it is and however they came to have it. And one of the things about good ideas is that they have to be flexible. You have to be willing to give up an idea or reconsider an idea when you get new information. So yes, that's a long-winded answer to your question, but I think we don't really... Look, I teach at a college, and we all know that in the last 10 years, there's been a lot of discussion about whether colleges are worth it, quote unquote. And especially, I teach at a liberal arts college, whether colleges that focus on the liberal arts aren't just an indulgence, a very expensive indulgence. I think the risk of giving up on colleges is that we will even more fully abandon the importance of ideas in our society. I think that's what a good college experience should do, should teach you how to pursue your ideas in a way that you probably weren't ready to do when you were 8 or 14. That said, I can tell you right now, when you get students, even I get the brightest students. I'm so lucky. I teach at a college with wonderful, wonderful students. But many of them did very well in school and they got high test scores, but they don't actually know how to build their own idea or really think through someone else's idea in an open-minded way. So I see that as the great value of a good college experience. But we are living in a time when that's not valued by the society, which is why you keep reading one op-ed after another and book and article about what a waste college is. That's like saying that ideas are a waste. And it's ironic because some of the people that are held up as great examples of why a college education isn't important are people whose ideas made them famous in the first place. So, you know, you can be a genius and very unusual, the dandelion in the cement, who is great at having ideas without having gone, had a great education or gone to college. But we can't depend on geniuses. We need a society filled with people who can build ideas and think about other people's ideas. And for that, we need, you know, a good education system.
Susan Engel is my guest. I'll return with her after this music break.
Rabbits have two eyes, and whales have two eyes, and eagles have two eyes, but Triops has three eyes. Triops has three eyes. Two eyes on a face are usually enough, but Triops has got one that looks up, and one that looks around, and one to keep an eye on the other pair of guys. Triops has three eyes. Have an eye, tornadoes have an eye, potatoes have a lot of eyes, but Triops has three eyes. Triops has three eyes. Everything with eyes has some amount of eyes, and Triops has got one that looks up and one.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'm joined by the author of The Intellectual Lives of Children, published by Harvard University Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Susan Engel is professor of psychology at Williams College, and her other books include The Hungry Mind, about curiosity in childhood, which she spoke about on this program when the book came out. So, Susan, you were talking about education, and I wanted to ask you about earlier education in schools. You observe in your book that children's ideas are rarely mentioned in a school setting, whether this is by well-meaning educators or parents who are focused on many other things like teaching the math facts and skills, teaching self-control, etc. But the ideas of children seem to be missing. What would it look like if they weren't missing? And do you think this is just a reflection of that larger societal disinterest in the ideas of children?
Well, let me start with the first part of your question, and then I can say something about, you know, what's keeping that from happening, because I think that's complicated. I think in the first place, and this I referred to before, children need a lot more opportunities to engage in play. And it's not just the freedom to play, it's opportunities to use interesting materials, to take time and play over a, you know, start a game that takes maybe days or weeks to play, whether it's a game in the dress-up corner or with blocks or a pretend activity outside if you're lucky enough to be in a school with an outdoor area. And adults can, you know, this is something Vivian Gussin-Paley has written wonderfully about in kindergarten classrooms. Adults can play a facilitating role in that. They don't have to just step aside. They don't need to be part of it all the time, but they can introduce new ideas at just the right moment or ask a question that pushes kids or prompts kids to enrich or elaborate their play or just offer, you know, more materials. So that's one thing in early childhood. The other thing that's really important starting in daycare, I mean, before kids get to formal schooling, is a lot more opportunity to talk. We have totally missed the boat by thinking of talk as something that happens on the way into the classroom or at recess, instead of being the sort of core of the curriculum. Conversation both between children and between children and adults is the key way that kids expand their intellectual horizons, learn to think about things in new ways, gather new information, learn how to ask questions and answer questions and revisit things. So conversation is really, really important. And schools would do well to make more time for that in the regular curriculum. or the regular school day. As kids get older, and this is something I talk about in the book, we should give them lots of chances to pursue their curiosity, to pursue the things that interest them. It's very hard to learn something you have no interest in. And it's not hard at all to learn things that you have a great interest in. And study after study has demonstrated this. When anybody, a grown-up or a child, is interested in something and wants to know something more, they absorb it quickly, easily, and then they remember it for a much longer time than something they are not interested in that they're required to learn. That actually sounds banal when you say it that way, because we all know it to be true. Think in your own life of the things you've learned easily. It's because you wanted to, you were interested. Paying attention to what children are interested in is essential. And it's not as hard as people think. I could return to that in a minute. I think when people say that would be too complicated if you have 23 kids in a classroom, I don't think they're thinking the right way about it, but I could go back to that. So having lots of opportunities to learn about things that interest you is essential, because it's not even whether you remember those particular things. It gives you practice at learning in a very efficient and powerful way. So it's the best kind of learning to engage in. The second piece that I devote a major section of the book about is children's capacity to invent, because ideas depend on curiosity, but they also depend on invention. Being able to put things together in a new way, as I said, to explain something or solve a problem. And this seems so obvious to me that children should spend lots of time in school inventing. They could be inventing with blocks or with, paper and pencil. They could be inventing with found materials or with objects provided to them. As they get older, their inventions can become more and more abstract, and inventing things in their head or writing about inventions or talking about inventions. So it can follow a progression that meets where kids are in their development. But it's, when you think about all the time that children spend in school solving problems they have no interest in solving, which doesn't give them a chance to become better inventors, and therefore doesn't give them a chance to become better at having ideas. And to really do your best at solving a problem, it has to be a problem to you. And again, think of all the times that you watch a child come upon a problem they really want to solve. So I give the example in the book of two kids trying to figure out a way to catch a lizard that was outside their house. They were so motivated to solve that problem, and eventually they figured out how to do it. And they had all the characteristics that we want for children in school and find so elusive. Like, they stuck with it, they were resourceful, they collaborated, they changed their thinking when they needed to. That was a problem they wanted to solve. And we spend a great deal of time in school trying to get kids to solve problems they don't want to solve. And they, even when they succeed, often it's by figuring out the quickest way to do it rather than really using the thought processes we most want them to use. So part of what could be different is giving children lots more chances in school to come up with the problems they want to solve, and then plenty of time to solve them. So that's another perhaps small thing, but I think it's important, which is giving kids a lot of time to solve the problems they want to solve. Because if you get a good problem that you really want to solve, it might take you some time to do it. And we tend to chunk children's learning into these tiny little bits and pieces, which, if the stuff they're learning is boring to them, it's just as well if it's in very short segments. But if they really are interested in it, they might like to spend a little more time on it. If you've ever, I visited a school where kids were lucky enough, it was in Oregon, and the kids were lucky enough to have some time outside in a kind of wild, messy area right outside the building. And the kids started building forts just with twigs and leaves. And they couldn't stop working on those forts for weeks and weeks and weeks. They were making their forts and then taking them apart and then rebuilding them. And, as a psychologist, I can tell you the intellectual skills that they were honing during the fort building were tremendous. And that's the kind of thing you could capitalize. It sounds very, I worry that it sounds too pastoral or too idyllic when I give these examples. And someone who teaches in a New York City classroom thinks this could never fit what I do. But that is not the case. For every example I've given of something bucolic, you know, twigs and forts, is an example of something that you could absolutely, the children could be doing in the most urban classroom with not a twig in sight. So I want to really be clear about that, because these are not just for the rural children or the very privileged children. These are should be at the heart of what's going on, in, I think, in every classroom.
Indeed. And the examples that you've just been giving are ones which highlight something else that you discuss in your book, The Intellectual Lives of Children, which is that children are especially predisposed to, when they do invent and try and figure out solutions, to do it collaboratively. Can you talk about that dimension of the mental process of children?
Sure. So mostly thanks to the pioneering work of Michael Tomasello, a developmental psychologist, we've learned a great deal in the last, I don't know, I'm probably going to get this wrong, but say 20 years, about how early it is that children start to collaborate. And it turns out, we used to think for a long time, and maybe it's still some teachers think this, Piaget, one of the mistakes he made, I think he was brilliant, but he made some mistakes, as every scientist does. And he really gave us this idea that children were what he called egocentric, were each doing their own thing for years and years, and couldn't coordinate their play or collaborate until they were, you know, four or whatever. And it's just not true. Children start to interact and collaborate with each other very early in life, but certainly by the end of the first year, they're paying attention to each other. They imitate each other, and it's very subtle. I have two small grandchildren who live in the same house as one another, even though they're cousins, not siblings. And when my grandson was a year and my granddaughter was whatever, 8 months old, he would play with something, and then a few minutes later, she would sort of touch the same toys he had just been playing with. She might not imitate the same exact, you know, action or gesture, but she was influenced by what he was doing. And very soon after, they began to sort of coordinate their behavior in these very subtle ways. So collaboration begins at a very early age, and is essential, when you think about it, to most ideas that we build and most inventions that we build. No one invents in a vacuum. Every invention, every idea incorporates, as I said before, information that we've gotten from other people and also ways of thinking that we might have borrowed from other people. And anyone, I mean, talk to any inventor or talk to any scientist, think about the process of science. We're always basing our, even what feel like our boldest discoveries or ideas, on things that have happened before, on the accumulation of human knowledge. So children do that with each other by sharing information, sharing strategies, sort of combining forces. And the social nature of intellectual work is essential. It's another reason why in classrooms children should have plenty of opportunities to work with one another, to talk with one another, because each of them will develop stronger thinking skills by doing that.
Susan Engel is my guest. She is a professor of psychology, director of the program in teaching at Williams College, author of The Intellectual Lives of Children. I'm Sasha Lilly. You know, the way you were describing the scientific process and the process of invention as being highly social and collaborative, that really runs against the stereotype people have in their minds often of how invention takes place. It's pictured as being something that kind of happens by accident, someone's sort of fumbling around and has a eureka moment, an invention is born. While you're not saying that doesn't ever happen, it seems that what is being missed here is that ideas, inventions come out of sustained engagement, which might even have been happening, you know, over a lifetime.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's this old wonderful quote, I'm going to botch it, but fortune favors the prepared mind. It's something like that. And I have a feeling it was either a philosopher or a scientist who said that. But there are many examples of, in fact, almost all examples of really powerful inventions and ideas come to people who in one way or another were already gathering the bits of information that they would need for that moment. Now, you can make a discovery that feels like it's happening in the moment, when suddenly everything comes together and you think, I know how to do this, or I know what explains this. But that, it just feels like a moment in time. In fact, it's built on a sort of whole history, sort of intellectual history that went on even outside of your awareness, or sometimes outside of your awareness. You know, you didn't know you were gathering bits of information or sort of. The other piece of this is about the importance of working and reworking ideas and inventions. Very few inventions work out right away. Usually they take several iterations, even the most accomplished inventions. Like I tell the story, I'm going to forget her name right now, but the person who invented whiteout, you know, liquid eraser, whatever it's called, she came up with that because she had taken some work home. This was in the days of typewriters, and she had typed something out for her boss and made a lot of errors and was desperate to fix it. And I think she mixed like nail polish or something and talcum powder or something or to cover over her mistakes. But that wasn't the end of it. That was a great sort of innovation in the moment. But she went on working on it until it became something that actually ended up making her a multimillionaire. And until we had compute, probably everybody listening to this is too young to even remember whiteout, but whiteout saved me all through college and graduate school. So I think of it as a very important invention. But it took her a lot of time to perfect it. And God knows anybody who thinks they've had a good idea, whether it's about democracy or how to cook a leg of lamb, which I'm cooking this weekend, or a child rearing, or anything you can think of, a better way to heat a house. Takes time. You have to mull it over. And so that's why it's sort of repeated efforts that bring us to good ideas. And it goes back to the thing I just want to go back to little kids. This is one of the things that really interests me. Children, given any opportunity and encouragement, like to return to ideas over and over again. So if you go back to the topics of sex or death, or infinity, something I write about in the book, because many children are totally fascinated by the problem of infinity. They don't just bring it up once. They keep returning to it. And they return to it the same way scientists or, engineers or even, policymakers return to their ideas, which is not all in one day. They keep returning over time. So that should be encouraged because it's very valuable to have that kind of perseverance.
Yes, and that also, as you write, goes against the way that adults have thought about how children think and even studied how children think, that they think that when they are curious or do have ideas, they're momentary experiences rather than something that might be sustained over time. And the idea that children might sustain their inquiry into maybe abstract ideas is something that adults don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about.
No, they don't. And I will say that it's very hard to do research on those kinds of sustained lines of inquiry. I'm currently sort of working on this problem because you do an experiment and the kid comes into the lab and you give them the task and they can do the task or they can't, or you give them two chances at the task and you see what changes over time in the short period of time. But it's really hard to follow children over time. I'm one of many researchers who have been slightly flummoxed by how to do that. There's an amazing corpus of data that exists online now where you can study sort of diaries that parents have kept of their children over time. And that's an invaluable resource because, and a lot of researchers use that data bank because you can see examples of kids asking over and over again, for instance, about death or about invisibility, their various topics that children return to. But it's hard for researchers to capture that in the lab. On the other hand, teachers and parents do get access to these recurring themes and these sustained efforts to understand something. So one easy sort of takeaway from my work is that parents and teachers should avail themselves of that information because it's really potent and valuable in guiding how they interact with children. And I'm so jealous of them. Compared to the researcher, they've got all the good stuff. So they just need to pay a little more attention.
Well, let me ask you about that. You mentioned what schools could do differently to foster and even recognize the intellectual lives of kids. But I wanted to ask you about parents. We're often told that children today are given way more attention than in the past by their parents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yet you're also saying that parents really don't, by and large, recognize the internal world of ideas that their children have. How would you remedy that ignorance? Does it matter? Is there something parents could do to help foster those ideas? Is there also the danger of that in some sense being too intrusive?
I suppose a given parent might become too intrusive, but I worry less about that than the opposite, which is parents not giving children enough opportunities to explore these ideas. Or even, you know, one really simple thing that I've noticed and has come up in my research is the difference between parents who actually just talk about ideas, their own and their child's ideas, who use the word idea, that's an interesting idea, or, oh, there are different ideas. Like, imagine, think about all the kids who probably are curious about the idea of God, or as some wonderful research shows, ideas about other invisible and powerful creatures like the Tooth Fairy or Santa Claus. I mean, there are all kinds of fascinating invisible creatures kids might want to know about. When kids bring that up, we tend to say it's real or it's not real based on our own belief system, instead of saying, well, there are different ideas about that. How would you know if it was real or it's not real? I mean, those kinds of conversations are not complicated or hard or scary to have if you have a mindset to do that. So I certainly am not suggesting anything too complicated. God knows I'm not suggesting anything that requires a whole new effort to be the best parent. You know, this isn't a new job for parents to take on. It's more like a way of thinking. And part of it is just being interested in your child's thoughts and being willing to get into a conversation with them where you're having an idea or they're having an idea. After all, children collaborate with each other in building ideas, but they can collaborate with grown-ups. And you can talk about things you feel uncertain about, that you're interested in exploring, and that you say out loud, so what would we need to know if that were true or not? Or what might explain why people cry when such and such happens? So it's partly, it goes back to that idea of the willingness to engage in those kinds of exchanges. I suppose the parent who takes this too seriously and makes every conversation a kind of effort to help their child be even smarter and do better in school, that's not what I'm talking about.
I was also thinking, but I think you've answered this, that if parents are always giving absolute answers to things, you know, let's talk about ideas, here are the facts. How is that not different than what often happens in schools as well, which is you're learning facts and skills, but you're not necessarily learning how to pursue your own lines of inquiry?
You put that perfectly, wonderfully. And it's true. Parents, like teachers, get very nervous when kids ask them questions they don't know answers to. But it's such a great thing to talk about something you don't fully know the answer to. And it's great for your kid, and it's often more interesting. So I've said this for many years. One guide to this is whether you actually are interested in the conversations you're having with your kids. And you might be interested because you're interested in learning how they think about things. Like, where'd you get that idea? Or what made you think that? Or what else, you know, is that all? Do you always think that's true? There are questions you can ask that give you clues about your child's thinking, but you might enjoy the conversation because the thing you're talking about is as interesting to you as it is to them. And God knows, who gets tired of talking about death and sex? As two examples, they're not the only examples, but since we brought them up. I think it's very valuable for grown-ups to have conversations they enjoy with children. And by enjoy, I don't mean that make them feel good, but that are interesting and satisfying to them. You know, there's a big thing we haven't talked about here, but we did indirectly before, which is the value of teachers and parents in thinking about ideas themselves. And one of the best ways to make this more a part of your child's life, or as you put it, help your child pursue their own lines of inquiry or their own lines of thinking, is for you to do that too. And that's, you know, obviously I'm biased. I think the chance to think about ideas is one of the great gifts of being alive. So I think when teachers are given a chance, and parents, to engage in that, they're in a much better position to be able to encourage it with their children. Yeah.
Susan Engel, thank you so very much for your time today. It's been a pleasure having you back.
It was wonderful to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Susan Engel is professor of psychology at Williams College, where she's the director of the program in teaching. She's the author of a number of books, including The Intellectual Lives of Children, published by Harvard University Press, which we've been discussing today at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.